Greetings, listeners, if any, and welcome to DM Dad, the podcast about playing Dungeons & Dragons and other role-playing games with kids. A great way to spend time with your family, now that your friends are too old and have all moved away. I know what boys like, I know what guys want, I know what boys like, boys like me. That's probably the most famous song by The Waitresses, the 1980s post-punk band. To be fair, it's probably kind of an underrated song. I think most people make the mistake of taking it at face value. It's actually a satire on the male gaze and on sexual and romantic relations between men and women. Is a lot more intelligent and more scathingly satirical than a lot of people give it credit for. And also, the band, The Waitresses, are actually a lot more talented than people normally give them credit for. But why am I talking about The Waitresses? That's because today's Christmas carol comes from The Waitresses. It is the other famous song by The Waitresses, or at least according to Wikipedia it is. I, to be honest, never heard it in my life until like 2 years ago. And to be honest, I heard it at a Christmas fair over the PA, and I thought it might actually be by the Human League, like some bizarre song where they let the female vocalists do all the vocals. And I had to look it up later and find out my mistake. It is probably my third favorite Christmas song in the world ever. It kind of continues a theme from my last podcast about Christmas realism and about, you know, understanding that Christmas isn't about being happy all the time. This one is less, I mean, it's less comic. In fact, I don't think it's comic at all. And it's not depressing, but it is about somebody who's just finding the whole preparation and stuff a bit overwhelming, you know. They just don't have the time, so they're going to spend Christmas alone and just take the time to chill out rather than, you know, get involved in all the hoopla and stuff. And it has a happy ending as well, so it is in the long run an upbeat Christmas song. But, you know, as Lois Griffin famously said on an episode of Family Guy, you know, you all think Christmas just happened, that it just falls out of the sky. Well, it falls out of my holly jolly butt. Like, when you're a grown-up, and it's your holly jolly butt that Christmas has to fall out from, then the hustle and bustle and the frantic preparations and stuff of Christmas can be, they can seem like more of a blessing than a curse. So I can really relate to the speaker of this song, just tired of running around trying to sort stuff out and things, and just, you know, I'm just gonna chill out and spend Christmas by myself this year. So here is Christmas Rapping, which I assume is a pun on R-A-P-P-I-N-G, rapping, by The Waitresses.
your ski shop encounter? Most interesting, had his number but never the time. Most of 81 pass along those lines. So deck those halls, trim those trees, raise up cups of Christmas cheer. I just need to catch my breath, Christmas by myself this year. Count the picture, frozen landscape, chill this room for 24 days. Till summertime, out through the beach to his boat. Could I join him? No, this time it was me. Sunburn in the third degree. Now the calendar's just one page. Of course I am excited. Tonight's the night I've set my mind. I've been doing too much about it.
So as I've been doing these more frequent D&December podcasts, I've managed to accumulate quite a lot of voicemails. I wanted to throw some in the last one, but I was running long. I am trying to keep these shorter, at least under an hour. So I decided that I would just cram them all into the next episode and then use whatever time I had left over to discuss an actual topic. So let's start answering these voicemails.
Hey, Dr. Groves, it's Rich from Cockatrice Nuggets. So totally unrelated to gaming, but you mentioned X-Files and how you liked the Monster of the Week, but not the mythology because it kind of didn't go anywhere. Was wondering, did you ever watch Fringe? If not, you really should. I enjoyed the heck out of it. And I think the Monster of the Week and the mythology both made it a great show. So, hey, if you haven't, check it out.
Thanks for that, Rich. No, I never did watch The Fringe. In fact, I never even heard of it, and I had to look it up after your voicemail. I can't believe I haven't heard of it. It looks really interesting. So I will have to put that on my to watch list and check that out. I do note that it is not available on Netflix, and I'm a Netflix subscriber, so that could present a problem because I'm not keen on having multiple streaming subscriptions. There are times when I struggle to even make proper use of my Netflix subscription, and then you feel like you're paying for it for nothing. So I'll have to look into the options for checking that out, but it definitely looks like it would be up my street, especially if both aspects of the show, mythology and Monster of the Week, are done well. So thanks for that suggestion.
Hi Robert, it's Colin Spike Pit. Just listening to your Black Hack episode. It went under the radar for me, not sure why. I picked up second edition Black Hack and I'm in the process of going through it. But you mention a game system where the criticals damage the armor and you get wear and tear on fumbles. I believe you'll find that is Knave by Ben Milton. You've probably read that, mate. Unless there's another one. But I'm guessing you've worked it out by now. Cheers then. Great episode. Catch you later.
Thanks for that, Colin. You are absolutely correct. It is Knave. And in fact, I actually remembered it after I posted the episode. I just couldn't for the life of me remember it at the time. I've read Knave. I haven't had a chance to run it yet. And I'm kind of planning to make a kind of Knave Maze Rats hybrid. Because there are aspects of both games that I like, but I mean, one thing I really missed about Knave was the absence of all the random tables that you get in Maze Rats. I don't think I could do without those. As for the Black Hack going under your radar, yeah, so I recorded a really long review of the Black Hack, and I published it, and it just sat there doing nothing. Like zero listens. And I left it for a little while, just thinking, oh, maybe people are too busy to listen or something, or they'll get to it. But after a few days, it's like, well, I'm sure I should at least have it like single digits of listens. And I noticed, friends, I follow myself on Spotify, and I can use that to make sure that the episodes have been uploaded to the multiple platforms, because it was showing up on Anchor, but it didn't show up on Spotify, and the first of my D in December podcasts showed up on Spotify, so it skipped the Black Hack. So I said, well, there must be a problem with the episode. But the only thing I could think of was that it was slightly longer than my longest episodes. So I cut one segment, a segment where I talked about some of my woes with the Anchor app. And it was still over an hour, but as soon as I cut that segment and then saved it, it appeared magically everywhere, and now people have had access to it. So that will be why it flew under your radar, is that for a while after I published it, it was not being uploaded. There must be some kind of episode time limit that we're not aware of or that hasn't been widely published. If anybody actually knows what that time limit is and where it's stated that you can't have an episode longer than I'm going to guess an hour and 15 minutes, maybe phone in and tell me where I can find that fine print. I mean, to be fair, we probably should try to keep our episodes under an hour. But anyways, that will be the explanation for that. And that's also why I'm putting all the call-ins in this episode.
Hey, this is Ray Otis from Plundergrounds, and I, for one, have really been enjoying your musical treatises, tirades. I'm not sure what you call them, but they are educating and enlightening and interesting. I especially like this last one about Judy Garland. You did a masterful job of summarizing the plot of Meet Me in St. Louis, which I had not seen before. And I will say, though, that even not knowing that story, I've always had the Judy Garland version in my playlist and preferred it, even though it's slow and sad in a way. And I've always gotten that exact emotion out of it that I now know why I get that emotion, but it was always there even before I knew the story. Now I know the story, which makes it even better. But that just shows you how amazing of a singer Judy Garland is when she puts that, she can get that emotion across through the song. It's not just singing the words, it's singing the meaning. So love it. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Ray. And it's good to hear some feedback on the music, because it is weird. And it is only for this month. So if any of you aren't cool with it, don't think that this is going to be my new thing. I do feel a little bit like Patrick Bateman, like putting these songs in there and then rambling on about them and stuff like that. Like, am I losing touch with reality here? But I totally agree. There's really nobody like Judy Garland. There's a lot of people in the world of musical theater who can act fine and sing fine, but they can't act and sing at the same time. It's like they're two different skills and they have to switch between them. And, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, even the famous Let It Go from Frozen, the power of that song is from the song itself, but she's not actually acting the emotion. I've heard people do a rendition of a song in a musical that is closer to the emotion of the character, where really she's just belting out a good song. And that's also why that song works as a single, because you don't have to be watching the film to get it. I'm not actually a huge fan of musicals, to be honest. There's probably like five musicals that I like, and one of them is the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So that probably gives you an idea of where my tastes lie. But yeah, we do watch Meet Me in St. Louis every Christmas, even though it is technically not a Christmas film, because it has that iconic scene with that iconic Christmas song. And it has a lot of humor in it and everything. It's and as a part of musical or Hollywood history, it's the film where Judy Garland and Vincente Minnelli met and fell in love, and you know, that union produced Liza Minnelli. And apparently they're the only family in the history of Hollywood where mother, father, and daughter have all won Oscars. So there's a bit of trivia for today.
Hey man, Eric Salzwittle of the Omega 3D Chicken Coop calling in, and I'm calling in regards to your D&D December topic of clerics and warlocks. And there's a part of it where I definitely agree with you on, and that is the fact that the warlock class seems pretty unnecessary to me. I've always envisioned warlocks as evil wizards that happen to commune with demons or evil deities of that nature. I do like the idea and think it's definitely doable with having the warlock essentially be the evil cleric that just doesn't know healing spells, which also works in my opinion. The one area where I will disagree with you on is I'm one of those people that actually like to play the hybrid characters that aren't very good at fighting or magic, but have a broader character skill base or ability base. I like to have utility type characters that in any given situation can add to the adventure in some way. Anyway, those are just my opinions, man. Keep it up. I'm enjoying the rapid fire December episodes.
Thanks for that, Eric. I hadn't actually considered, like, you know, multi-classing, dual-classing, and other hybridized characters from the utilitarian perspective before. I think I've always just perceived it as a min-maxing thing. So that's an interesting way to look at it. I personally try to play utilitarian characters myself. It's kind of my favorite role. Sort of like, you know, like being in a band. You know, everybody wants to be the lead guitarist or the lead singer, but your band's going to sound pretty dorky if you don't have a bass player. And I actually do play bass guitar. It was my first instrument. So, that's kind of the rule. It's like, nobody's going to think to be the bass player and you're going to need one. But I've always kind of done that as either like I play the cleric or I play the thief, but I play a thief as utility and skills, not as stealing crap from the party. But I hadn't thought about how that, you know, multi-class characters who can do a little bit of more than one thing or a little bit of everything are actually good utility players. I guess I was just too focused on the stereotype, especially of things like bards and stuff that, you know, that people who are attracted to bards, to the bard class, are trying to be what Canadians would call shit disturbers. So, but it kind of makes me want to maybe try some of this out next time I'm rolling up a character, to try a multi-class character for utility reasons rather than, you know, to try to have my cake and eat it too. So thanks for that.
Hey man, how's it going? Eric Salzwittle here of the Omega 3D Chicken Coop. I'm just calling in regards to your most recent player skills episode, and I totally agree with you. I was a heavy 3.5 player. It was the only thing people were playing at the time, so I played it. And very similar to Pathfinder, as you noted. And that is absolutely correct. The player skill in a 3.5 derivative game is based on your ability to create a character and then apply the rules within the game to give yourself advantageous bonuses during combat or other non-combat related situations. And just like you said, playing an old school style or classic gaming style game, it is definitely more about your ability to think and apply your character to the best of your ability and work around your disadvantages. Anyway, man, great episode. Keep it up.
Hey, Robert. Frank T. here. Frank T.'s Liner Notes. Just listening to your recent Anchorcast about player skills. And until you brought it up, I never realized the sort of inverse relationship there between older style games and the players having skills during the game versus Pathfinder style games, where the player skill actually lies before the game is played. Great stuff. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to hearing more.
So that was a couple of call-ins on the skills episode. Eric Salzwedel again and Frank T. I'm really glad that episode went off well, because as I mentioned in the episode, I had been thinking about doing it as a blog post for a long time, and I mean I even had drafts of it. I felt like I never got the wording right, or it was too long, and I was worried people wouldn't quite understand what I was trying to say. And I decided I'm just gonna shoot my mouth off about it here on my podcast. And I'm glad to see that it went down well. Because it's a thing, like, it's very easy in the different factions and contingencies of role playing to fall into one style's good and one style's bad. I mean, one of my earliest experiences with the OSR was I joined some Facebook groups devoted to AD&D. One was a first edition group and one was a second edition group, and I joined them both because I liked them both. You know, I know some people hate second edition AD&D. I kind of feel like second edition AD&D is like the Return of the Jedi of D&D editions. It's the one that everybody hated until fourth edition came out. Just like everybody hated Return of the Jedi because of the Ewoks, having no idea that they were someday going to experience Jar Jar Binks. But I think second edition AD&D is a good game, and I would happily play it or run it. But when I joined both of those groups, what I expected is that people would talk about what they liked about the game and the system. And instead, they spent most of their time complaining about how their kids were playing 5th edition. Although, weirdly, the thing they hated most of all, both groups, was each other. People complained endlessly about 2nd edition AD&D in the 1st edition group, and endlessly about 1st edition AD&D in the 2nd edition group. It's kind of like this scene in Life of Brian where, you know, the only thing we hate more than the Romans is the fucking Judean People's Front. It's like, okay. So yeah, I was really worried that, or the thing that inspired me to do this episode about the different type of player skills is that it isn't a one's good, one's bad thing. they're different and they use different skill sets. And probably the most you can say is that you prefer one to the other. I definitely prefer one to the other. But I also recognize that I don't really have the skill set to make the best use of the style that that isn't my preferred style. So believe it or not, I don't set out to make hour-long podcasts. I never sit down and go, I'm going to talk for an hour and a bit about this damn, this or that damn thing. It just happens. And I really was hoping to make this one shorter. I was even actually going to just basically do a call-ins only, just play the call-ins and a quick response to them. To keep the running time down, because I know not everybody has hours and hours to listen to podcasts. And also because I couldn't decide on another topic, like a specific topic for this this episode. But then that changed when I got this call-in, which I received just this morning.
Hey, Dr. Graves, it's Rich from Cockatrice Nuggets. Yeah, so ever since you started doing these Christmas carols, and I'm a couple episodes behind, mind you, I've been thinking about Bad Religion in my head, and boom, there it is. Third one. Yeah, Bad Religion. All right. So, yeah, I saw these guys in concert, and it was a holiday show put on by a local radio station, and they were like, hey, so I think the only reason they invited us here is because they wanted to hear Bad Religion sing some Christmas carols. So half of their entire set was Christmas carols. It was an interesting show and my first real exposure to punk Christmas carols. Another one of my favorite genres that came from that is punk show tunes. Check out Punk Side Story, one of my faves. Take it easy.
Wow, I am definitely going to check out Punk Side Story. That just sounds phenomenal. I'm probably going to go look that up on Spotify immediately after recording this. Maybe someday in the future, I will play some punk show tunes on my podcast, although I'm not sure what kind of a holiday occasion would warrant that. Maybe summer vacation, I don't know. But yeah, although that particular message has nothing to do with gaming, that's two messages from Rich in one podcast, and it just put me in mind of a couple of things. So one is that Rich wrote an article on the High Level Games blog about metagaming. It's called 5 points in favor of metagaming. And I really like this article. Disclaimer, I already agree with all of the points. So it's not like he converted me to accepting metagaming. It's like it more like preaching to the converted. But I mean, if you have strong feelings about metagaming, I think you should read this article. A lot of what some people call metagaming, it just doesn't bother me. First of all, he makes some really good points. Like point one is it's a game, and it's basically like, look, whenever you refer to the game mechanics, even to like making attack rolls and saving throws and things like that, whenever you describe what you're doing in terms of the rules of the game rather than trying to narrate it, you are metagaming. You're drawing attention to the fact that it's a game and not a story. I think, you know, there is a way to play with absolute beginners, and the DM rolls all the dice, including the player's attack rolls, and they say, I attack with your sword, and you roll their die in secret, and you say, unfortunately, your sword swings wide, and things like that. But, you know, that's not how... nobody plays like that. You know, everybody rolls their own dice. You know, whenever you invoke your feat or something like that, you're metagaming. But one of the things that I think people definitely complain about more is, you know, he uses the example when you're fighting a troll, going right for the fire and the acid. And, you know, if it's a first level party and they've never fought a troll, but the players know that trolls will regenerate unless they're hit with fire or acid, how could you know that and stuff? Personally, I would never, as a game master, I would never call a player out on that, because I view D&D as a survival challenge, and I'm not going to handicap the players and stop them doing something that will increase their chances of survival. And in a similar way, I'm not going to bar them from taking certain actions because their intelligence score isn't, you know, high enough. Even though the description of the ability scores in the first booklet of the original game, Men in Magic, specifically states that intelligence may prevent you from taking certain actions if it's too low. But I mean, I would never say, well, you've only got a 5 intelligence, you wouldn't think of that plan. It's like, if it's a good plan and the player thought of it, that's the point of the game for me. But one thing I particularly liked about Rich's article is that he found a way to justify metagaming, like in that troll example. So if somebody really wants to make up a stink about this, you could shut them up with this argument. And this, he basically asks, how do you kill a vampire? I mean, if you take anybody off the street and just say, excuse me, but how would you kill a vampire? They will name a number of things. And while all the things that you could name that might kill a vampire won't necessarily kill a D&D vampire, I don't think garlic is a big thing, at least not for 5th edition vampires. Some of them definitely will kill a vampire. Vampires are harmed by running water in D&D. A stake through the heart will at least immobilize them. Fire, sunlight, you know, these things do affect them. And like, we all know how to kill a vampire. And vampires aren't even real. But imagine if we lived in a world where vampires were real. You know, that knowledge would be relevant at some point. So you're also saying, well, you live in a world where trolls are real, where dragons are real. So even if you've never met one, just think like how much we know about how to kill mythical creatures when they don't even exist. If they did exist, even if you didn't meet them on a regular basis, or even if you could live your whole life not meeting them, of course you would know. You would. People would be like, oh my God, it's a troll. I've heard these things are susceptible to fire and acid. You know, so it's perfectly justifiable. So yay for metagaming. And yeah, like that doesn't bother me at all. If there's a bespoke monster or a monster that's unique to Dungeons and Dragons, or, you know, like something that I made up, or it only exists in the module, and the players find some way to know how to defeat it. I mean, it sort of depends, because if it's a matter of they looked at the book when they weren't supposed to or something like that, well, that's bad. That's not cricket, you know? But in a way, they're also cheating themselves out of the experience. But if they're not cheating, I as a game master would give them some sort of clue as to what the creature is, what it does, and how to defeat it. You know, I wouldn't just hand them the answer on a plate, but there would be some clues. I mean, otherwise it's not fair, you know. For instance, in a game, the 5th edition game that I'm a player in, We recently encountered a gelatinous cube, and I knew it was a gelatinous cube because it was a 10x10x10 dungeon corridor, and the DM said, it's suspiciously clean. Now, that's the key word for gelatinous cube. You know, whenever you find a 10x10x10 dungeon corridor and the floors look like they've been swept and scrubbed clean, that means there's a gelatinous cube there. I could see by the DM's face that he was thoroughly enjoying this encounter. And I could also see by the other players' faces that they didn't get it. They didn't know the cue. So I didn't spill the beans. I didn't say, oh, it's a gelatinous cube. And therefore, I didn't step into the damn corridor. And then one of the other players did and was engulfed and, you know, dissolved into nothingness, basically. And we eventually defeated the gelatinous cube, but we couldn't recover his body. So I scraped up the goo that remained into a glass vial, took it back to town, and set it in the local temple so that there would be some kind of monument to our fallen comrade. But there's no chance of resurrection. And You know, you might say, well, if I had metagamed more, I might have saved his life. And I did use my metagaming knowledge to save my own life by not going anywhere near that corridor. But I tried to do it in game. You know, I like, I kept trying to bring them back to, why do you think the floor is clean? And I made a show of asking the DM, were any of the other dungeon corridors clean? And he's like, no, they had rubble and detritus and bones and stuff like that, you know. And all the other players are like, maybe an evil wizard lives here and he's enchanted a bunch of brooms and they've been sweeping the place clean like in Fantasia. And it's like, yeah, you know. I don't know. I did my best. So, anyways, yeah, metagaming saved my character's life, although it failed to save my companions' lives. To be fair, my character's alignment was chaotic neutral, and I had already lost one character to that game. In fact, of the five players at the time, three of us had lost characters, so if anybody ever tells you that you can't die in 5th edition... just tell them that's because the DM isn't running it right. Our DM is brutal and creative and inventive, and I mean, one of us was killed by ordinary badgers, which I'm now going to start putting in my games because those things are flipping fierce. But anyways, yeah, I definitely recommend you check that article out. So like, once again, it is called 5 points in favor of metagaming, and it is on the High Level Games blog. So Google that, and I'm sure you'll find it. Maybe also posted in some of the Facebook groups and stuff, which is actually how I spotted it in the first place. And it put me in mind of another blog post that I read this week. This is on the Hex Junkie blog. So it's another blog that I follow. And I was initially attracted to it because of its title, Knowledge Checks Are Stupid, which is a purposefully incendiary title. The author doesn't literally mean that knowledge checks are stupid, and neither do I by promoting it, but he makes some very good points about how knowledge checks can be used or misused in a lot of D20 skill check type systems. The blog post itself has a very humorous opening. It opens with a dialogue between a player and a game master. The player asks, "Does a bear shit in the woods?" The DM replies, "You might know, but your character doesn't. Give me a nature check." 7. "You're unsure whether bears do indeed shit in the woods." And then the author goes on to say, "I wish I was being facetious, but this is a legitimate entry in the D&D 4E Monster Manual. Bears live in forests. Your character can only know that if you roll a 15, which represents moderate difficulty." And then he actually has a screenshot of the 5th edition Monster Manual. So, bear lore. A character knows the following information with a successful nature check. DC 15. Bears generally live in forests and caves. And then there's some other information. But yeah, the basic fact about where bears live is a DC 15 nature check. Now, my kids are in the next room. I imagine if I went and asked them, "Guys, do bears poo in the woods?" they would give me the correct answer, even though they've never met a bear and they've never been to the woods. And what follows then is a very entertaining but informative and convincing article about whether you should be using skill checks, especially knowledge checks, to deny knowledge to your players. Now, I've talked before about my feelings about D20 skill-based systems. Not a fan of them. Try not to use them. Knowledge checks are among my least favorite of the skill check family. I've just grown so tired of feeling compelled to ask for a skill check every time a character has a question about something. And you know, to bring it back to Rich Fraser's article, you know, if you live in a world where monsters are real, even if you have never seen one before, you probably have some base knowledge about at least what people generally believe about monsters. So are you going to say, like, what if somebody decides, well, my character's never fought a troll, but I know trolls are susceptible to fire. Can I do a nature check or an arcana check or some, you know, check to see if I know that? And it's like, well, look, man, you know that, you know. You ask who the king is in the next country, you probably heard of him, just like you probably know the names of, you know, famous and prominent politicians in real life. You know, you probably know some basic geography. And okay, you can argue, oh, in the medieval world, they didn't know that much about the world outside of them. And it's like, well, you know, fair enough, but somebody must know. And it's a bit, you're a well-traveled adventurer, you know, you're probably a little bit above the curve in that respect. And the article talks about the impulse to deny information and about how this is really not a good idea. It's actually counterproductive for your game. And that in turn reminded me of a tweet from the Pink Dice GM Twitter account. I'm not a fan of Twitter, but I do follow a few gaming accounts. And the Pink Dice GM has a lot of really good advice. And recently, he, or possibly she, I have no idea, tweeted that whenever you give your players information, you probably feel like you've given them too much. But keep in mind that you see the big picture, you know all the secrets. They're seeing only small pieces. So you haven't given too much away. They're still going to, you know, have the fun of piecing these things together, figuring out what they really mean. And, you know, this ties in with a lot of the things, a lot of the game theory that I buy into now, you know, the Courtney Campbell things about, you know, you need to give your players information, otherwise they can't make an informed choice, which the Hex Junkie also points out that the information is necessary for them to make choices. Or it's specifically stated in the Maze Rats rule set that you should reveal the world. That's the actual phrase that Ben Milton uses. In fact, it's actually a heading, reveal the world. You know, tell your players things about the world and how it works when it becomes relevant. Don't just, you know, be coy about it. You don't have to gamify knowing basic facts about their world and their environment. And, you know, some of this denial of information does relate to what people call metagaming and knowing too much about monster weaknesses. You got to remember, though, players don't always remember every single thing just because they've run the game or read the monster manual. They won't necessarily remember every detail. I, for one, have a hard time remembering which of the oozes are susceptible to which type of damage. And I know that there's one that splits into little oozes if you hit it with lightning. And I believe it's the black pudding, but especially in the heat of battle, I'm liable to forget that. And then I'm afraid to use either lightning damage or slashing damage against it because I can't remember which one will simply split into two smaller ones when they do it. Although I do remember that the flesh golem is healed by lightning. But, you know, your players will forget things like that. Or, you know, like in my earlier example, where I clicked right away that there was a gelatinous cube, but nobody else seemed to. And it's not like we're all novices. You know, we've all been playing D&D. I guess just a lot of people have never actually fought a gelatinous cube before. Or they just didn't figure it out. It was too subtle a clue in the moment. And, you know, it's always harder to remember these things when you're on the spot. You know, remember that your players are seeing your world only through what you tell them. And that's like looking at everything through a small peephole, you know, whereas you have the whole thing in front of you. So, you know, for most things that even fifth edition would require a knowledge check, you might as well just tell them. You know, the poor wizard making arcana checks, you're a wizard, you know about magic. Just tell them. You know, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, let them identify their magic items without, you know, going through any rigmarole or something. But if they want to know about, you know, the, like, if there's a country with evil wizards in it, they probably know that. I mean, remember, even the hobbits had heard of Mordor. They, you know, didn't know as much about it as Gandalf. But when people mention the name Mordor, they're like, ooh, that place is scary, let's not talk about it. Or a shudder would go through them or something. I know some people like to make elaborate player's guides that have all the common knowledge and stuff like that. But the last thing I need to do is make my players take a reading test before they play my game. So basically, when a detail becomes relevant and they ask about it, if it's common knowledge, I let them know. And that's how I communicate my world building. But, you know, everyone will have their own style. I guess, like, one thing that the Hex Junkie article points out and that I would also echo is that if you're going to put a piece of knowledge on the other side of a skill check, you know, a dice roll that is possibly going to fail, you need to be prepared to accept both outcomes, success and failure. And if that information is essential to completing the quest, then, you know, the outcome of failure is the quest never gets completed and the party will have to go do something else. So you obviously don't want to put anything too vital, you know, as the result of a skill check. But then if it's not vital, then what's the point of rolling for it? Why not just tell them? Anyways, there can be any number of opinions on this, and I've rambled on quite a lot. I was initially reluctant to discuss this because I thought, especially after my kind of olive branch thing about the different types of player skills, it would seem like I'm now coming down on player skills. But then it occurred to me that this isn't really a post about playing with skills is bad. It's just that a certain type of skill check could maybe use a bit more thought. So anyways, yeah, I've rambled on long enough about this. We're probably coming up for an hour. So until next time, play well and let the dice fall where they may.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.